My next guest on Conversations with Apollo is the chairman of the Save Skylab organization, Tom Hancock. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Tell us about the Skylab Restoration Project.
The Skylab Restoration Project was started by the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics last year in an effort to save the first Skylab trainer from decay and degeneration to the point where it wouldn't be salvageable. Back in June of last year, several of our members discovered the Skylab trainer sitting out in a parking lot. It had been abandoned for about 7 years and was in pretty bad shape. So we approached the authorities at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, who gave us permission to start an effort to save the Skylab. And we concentrated primarily on the first deck, or the crew deck, and got that pretty well cleaned up, found a lot of interesting things. It had been exposed to wind and weather, snow and dirt, animals for that seven-year period. We found everything from birds' nests and equipment lockers to having to chase out a couple of raccoons with a broom. It was pretty cool. A lot of the surfaces were covered in animal droppings and mold. Discovered, you know, a lot of interesting things. I have to tell you, you've never smelt something as fragrant as dried raccoon poop when you tried to scrape it up and rehydrate it to get it off a bulkhead.
Not to mention to get rid of the odor.
Oh, yeah. It was interesting. We used Febreze and bleach, and Target mold remover did a pretty good job. But we got it down to the metal, and some places, acids and other things had eaten through the paint. Most of it was pretty much intact. A lot of the fabric surfaces was destroyed, and we had to replicate a bit of that. A lot of the structure was wood, believe it or not, because it was a mock-up. And a great deal of the wood was pretty severely damaged or rotted away. We started repairing most of it, got a good bit of it in place. There were a couple of sections we had yet to start before we had gotten closed down for the winter. It was full of flight hardware, everything from the ergometer to the crew shower to blister patches, food canisters, speaker systems, intercom systems, parts of different experiments, bits and pieces of Apollo spacesuits. It was amazing the things we found sitting out in those lockers. But we collected it all, archived it pretty well, and put it all for storage. We had about 45 people join in to help, and this was everything from engineers and scientists at the Marshall Space Flight Center to students. We had freshmen at UAH. We had couple of elementary school kids come with their parents.
That's UAH, that's University of Alabama at Huntsville?
University of Alabama in Huntsville, absolutely. We had high schoolers come from Bob Jones High School and Grissom High School in Huntsville, Alabama, and Madison, Alabama. And we had some pretty good welding and machinists come out that helped us with things, with bolts and systems that had been rusted over or just completely eroded to the point where we couldn't get them off. We ended up dremeling out a lot of things just to get them removed. I'd say about 80% of the things that are within it are salvageable. There is some history that's been lost, unfortunately. Just comes from being abandoned out in the elements for so many years. But most of it will end up being saved. The plan for Skylab is to turn her over to a professional restoration group, the same group of people I understand that just got through doing the Saturn V that's here in Huntsville, Alabama. It's going into our new Saturn V building. They'll spend about a year, year and a half on it, get it as good-looking and as intact as it was the day they set it outside, and they'll put it on display back in the main museum building where it will be tied to the Apollo history. We have the Apollo 15 command module out here. We have an Apollo lunar module. We have the very first Skylab ever, the very first Saturn V ever built, a dynamic test article that was assembled here at Marshall, then barged down to the Cape and assembled down there and taken out to the pad and moved back to Marshall. We have one of the very first boilerplates that was used in abort testing. That's going to go on the front end of our Saturn V. And our Skylab will tie it all together because Skylab was probably the greatest use of Apollo residual hardware. And other than going to the moon, it probably had the greatest impact on the space program. Because it was a pretty high fidelity simulator, we learned a lot about how America built space stations 30 years ago. The differences between it and the International Space Station, the U.S. Laboratory, U.S. Airlock, and U.S. Nodes were built here in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Marshall Space Flight Center. And some of our volunteer members helped to build the International Space Station. So it was kind of an interesting engineering challenge to see the things that went into making Skylab function with the technology of the day versus how we're doing things now.
It sure does look like, just looking at the photographs, it sure does look like it could, that design could be just as viable today as it was 30 years ago.
It very much could be. In fact, it's amazing how large it is when you get to the upper deck. It's 3 or 4 times the volume, as an example, of the U.S. laboratory module. If we had a system in place 10 years ago when we started flying space station modules, it would have been better to have put something the size of Skylab up, because of just the opportunity to do so much more. You could improve systems, the GNC, the guidance, navigation, and control, the ECLIS, the environmental control, life support, subsystems. All of these could be done with a tenth the space and a 20th the weight that they were done for Skylab, making even more volume available for experimentation, for crew habitat. But the biggest thing that was evident in Skylab, more than the science that they were able to do, the Apollo telescope mount, was learning to live and build structures in space. You could see how they were learning to manage and control the systems, how they were learning to maintain the different aspects of Skylab, how they were able to do in-flight maintenance. There's several good NASA histories about Skylab post-flight that showed the challenges they went through. A good example, they lost 2 of the momentum gyros on board Skylab, and we actually found the engineering version of the six-pack gyros sitting in the mock-up of a multiple docking adapter that they used to trade out on orbit. So they actually tested it here at first in Huntsville, physically set it in the multiple docking adapter, made sure the cables were to run, used flight hardware, and then flew the real thing up to Skylab.
They also, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't they also test the manned maneuvering unit jetpack on Skylab?
They sure did. They tested it twice. They couldn't take it outside because of its size and the size of the airlock, but they had enough volume inside the upper deck on Skylab to complete the entire flight program. And it's kind of an interesting picture to see the astronaut with a football helmet and a pair of safety shoes whipping around in the backpack. One does exist. There is one flight version of the backup available. It's at the National Air and Space Museum, if anybody would ever like to see it.
Well, speaking of the National Air and Space Museum, I remember a couple of years, about, I think it was about eight or nine years ago when I was at the Air Space Museum, going through the Skylab mock-up that they have there. And I'd seen pictures about how big it actually was, but until you actually go through it, and this thing was immense.
It is immense.
I mean, it's got to be a gargantuan job to be able to restore something so large. I was just amazed at how much room Skylab actually gave the astronauts.
Oh, absolutely. And that's probably something we won't see until we go back to the moon in 10 or 15 years, to have structures that large that people can do things in. The Skylab that's in the National Air and Space Museum is the flight backup. That's a fully functional space station. Had the first Skylab not been able to have been salvaged, they would have launched that one in its place. But it's fully outfitted. Years ago, I did an internship with the National Air and Space Museum, and all of its lockers and drawers are full of flight hardware. It's amazing to see the things that are sitting in there. But it would have gone. It was ready to rock. What they did differently is there's a maintenance hatch that allowed the ground crew to be able to outfit Skylab when it was sitting integrated on the Saturn V. That was closed out prior to flight before they would apply the micrometeorite shield. They removed that and the micrometeorite shield for the Skylab backup that's at the National Air and Space Museum, so it more closely resembles the flown space station. But it's a remarkable bit of history. It's something we should be proud of. And one of the big reasons why we wanted to save the Skylab trainer that's out here in Huntsville.
So in comparison to the two, The things that you just mentioned are pretty much the only differences between the engineering prototype and the actual backup flight hardware?
The primary differences are some wooden structures. There are some systems that are just painted on buttons, but they didn't really matter. As an example, the crew toilet on our mock-up didn't function, nor the one obviously in the Skylab backup did. But about everything else, almost all the electrical systems were fully functional. You could get the proper readings and things of that nature. Most of the experiment systems functioned. We had functional scientific airlocks, like the one they used to put up, the SunShield, Save Skylab. We had a functional fan system. We could vent and duct atmosphere. We had flight water tanks so that they could drain and use those systems. We had a functional galley. They had a real crew table, and they could take water up and eat food and do all that good stuff and practice the things they needed to do. So it was pretty close. And with all the crew training hardware, most of it being flight hardware that was inside, it was spot on. It, you know, just the way you'd want to train if you're going to go and spend 84 days in low Earth orbit.
So tell me the current status of the restoration project, how much it's going to cost to do, and what do you need from our listeners?
Right. We were told, it was estimated by the Space and Rocket Center that our efforts for the 6 or 7 months we were operating was worth about $1 million. They need another $1 million to complete restoration, and they'd like that to be done by a professional restoration group. So what we'd like listeners to consider doing is sending any amount to our PayPal account on safeskylab.org, or write to us. The Space and Rocket Center is requesting some temporary shelters and geodesic domes that we can place over the different artifacts while they wait to go into a permanent building. And those are about $6,000 each. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics has agreed to buy one. But anybody out there that would, you know, care to contribute, we'd more than welcome to have it. You get the building named after you or whoever you so designate, which is kind of a way of living on in perpetuity. But we really need people to write in, keep the effort going, write to the Space and Rocket Center, let them know that this is a critical, important part of history and that they need to continue the drive to saving it and that years can't keep rolling by before it's finished.
And where can they write the project?
Yeah. Send a letter to Irene Wilhite, curator, U.S. Space and Rocket Center, Huntsville, Alabama, 35812. The website is ussrc.com.
And how about the Save Skylab website?
Oh, absolutely. SaveSkylab.org.
That's .org, not .com. There is a SaveSkylab.com, which does not go to the project. So you got to make sure that it's a .org.
Right. .org. We weren't in time to get the .com, darn it, but... yes, absolutely. SaveSkylab.org. Every dime.
Right. Now, I understand that in addition to your efforts to restore this Skylab vehicle, you are also moving forward by working on the Orion project.
That's correct. I'm the avionics and software project engineer for the Ares 1, and helping put together the vehicle that will replace the space shuttle.
Now, explain the Ares 1 vehicle. That's the one that will take the crew up. Is that correct?
That's correct. Ares 1 is designed to take the Orion spacecraft from Cape Canaveral up to low Earth orbit. Initially, it's designed to support the space station. And eventually, in about 10 years, it'll be designed to rendezvous with an Earth departure stage and lunar module and go to the moon.
So my question is, obviously, other than money and the will of Congress and that type of thing, why is it going to take so long?
There are two things. There are two principal reasons. The most significant is NASA has not done this in almost 30 years. So there is a tax to be paid, and that is experience and learning how to build a human-rated launch vehicle again, how to build an expendable human-rated launch vehicle again, how to integrate the systems, and how to get that experience back inside NASA, not just to the contractor community. NASA's not giving a contract off to a Boeing or a Lockheed Martin saying, go make me a launch vehicle. They're doing it themselves. They'll give the production contract to to a Boeing or a Lockheed Martin or whoever it may be to actually go out and produce the systems in the factory. But the actual engineering, systems engineering, project engineering, mechanical, electrical, propulsion is all being done in-house at NASA. So that's the first reason. The second is it really is an issue of money. We have to finish out the International Space Station and meet our commitments to international partners. We have to finish flying the shuttle out to meet those commitments, and then it's just a simple matter of finding funds available. They're doing as much as they can within the money they've been given. I know that they're fully supported, but it's really an issue of making sure that we get everything done correctly. We want to finish the space station exactly, you know, safely and right on the money. We want to fly the shuttle out safely and do all the things necessary for that. And we want to make sure that Ares meets the needs of not only Orion, but of the country for the next 40 years.
So how does the Apollo experience translate to where we're going with Orion? Isn't a lot of the data that we learned through Apollo as far as navigation and engineering and all of that, does any of that at all translate to the new project? Can we look, I guess what I'm saying is NASA looking back on what we have done in order to learn so that we can do it again?
Absolutely. We're learning as much as we can. We have a class of engineer running around here at Marshall we call the Graybeard, and these are people that worked on the Apollo program. We're learning as many lessons as possible. We want to reuse as much hardware as possible. The JA2 motor is an example. It flew on the Saturn V and the Saturn 1B, and it's going to fly on the Ares 1 upper stage. The aerodynamics of the CEV capsule are very close to that of Apollo, so that's a lot of science we didn't have to reinvent. One of the reasons why Ares can carry more people than Apollo is the systems get to be smaller. We can do so much more with so much less space and less costly systems, and we can produce reusable systems so that we can take them from flight to flight to flight. We are looking at really smart ways of integrating the vehicle. We want to build it correctly. We want to integrate it in a way that's most efficient, least cost, and least technical and programmatic risk. And these are all the lessons we can get from the Apollo program. The key thing to remember is that the space shuttle is a dramatically different vehicle than Ares 1, and it was a dramatically different vehicle than the Apollo Saturn V or the Apollo Saturn 1B. So we need to stop. We're stopping to think less along the lines of shuttle and more along the lines of Apollo. So changing our outlook and changing how we view things and how we put vehicles together is different. So we have to make sure that we learn the best from Apollo, because Apollo was limited by the technology of the day. We're talking 40 years ago. And take in the best of the shuttle systems, the shuttle programs, and make sure that we maximize the new technology and integrate it in a way that we're able to build on the experience of the past program. It sounds like a lot of double talk, but it actually works well. You can do guidance, navigation, and control, or three-axis control, six-DOF control in the GNNC system on a much smaller, more higher fidelity system than you could with Apollo. And with the system that Draper developed, by all means, you want to do it. You don't want to replicate all the technology, because it's actually much more expensive to go back to an analog system than it would be to try to make it as digital as possible.
I taking a look at Orion, I almost want to call it the revenge of Wernher von Braun, because it's we seem to be going to Earth orbit rendezvous instead of lunar orbit rendezvous.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you think about the need of meeting our commitments to the space station, of getting a crewed ability to get from the surface of the Earth to low Earth orbit, Orion really does meet a basic need for human presence in space. If the next administration or the next Congress were to decide they didn't want to go to the moon for 25 or 30 years, we'd still have the ability as a nation to get to low Earth orbit, do it safely and with a lot of people. So part of the reason for building it the way we are is to build capability, meet the national need, fulfill the national will, and then press on to the next level. We're not integrating everything together like with Apollo, where it was all one shot. If you cancel the lunar program, you pretty much canceled the whole Apollo program.
So it's, in essence, learning from that lesson of putting
Absolutely.
All of our eggs in one basket and more or less hedging our bets by killing two birds with one stone and designing the next generation of rockets for launching in low Earth orbit, but can also handle the needs and demands of going to the Moon and Mars.
That's correct. Build with what you can, with what you can pay for. And that's what it's all about. And when we're ready and the country can pay for more, we'll do that.
Well, that's got to be a lot of fun for you.
It is. I couldn't pass this up for anything in the world. If I were independently wealthy, I'd pay them to let me do it.
I just came across that your website looking for the looking actually for the Safe Saturn V website, wanting to interview someone when they unveiled it, and I came across that, and I go, you know, we haven't done Skylab yet.
Very cool.
And I started thinking about when I did walk through the Skylab the flight hardware back at the Air Space Museum, and I was aghast at how big it was.
Oh, it shocks people when they stand inside and they look up and they see that there was about 35 feet from the surface to the top of that airlock. It just freaks people out. But, you know, the country made a decision in 72 to build a space shuttle that could take up modules to build a space station. They just spent 20 extra years deciding to build a space station.
As much as I really love the shuttle, I mean, I was at the first two landings.
Yeah.
With a million of my closest friends, and as much as I was really into the shuttle when I was younger, I've come to the realization that we really kind of went the wrong way.
I don't think we did. I think that what happened is the shuttle was one of four parts of an integrated program. It was build the shuttle, do the station at the same time, use the shuttle to put the station components up. Then from the space station, go back to the moon with a reusable capability, build a base on the moon, and go to Mars. They cut all that out except for build the shuttle. Had they followed and done the whole plan at once, there'd be people on Mars already.
Oh, I agree. No, I don't mean that we shouldn't have built the shuttle. I meant that we went the wrong way in that canceling everything else but the shuttle. That pretty
yeah,
much
I agree with
doomed
that.
Us for 30 years to go nowhere.
Yeah, I agree. It stuck the United States in the low Earth orbit for a generation, which is
I do have
wrong.
One question, though. I've often wondered, why is it that nobody, or did they, study the possibilities of adapting a shuttle design to actually go to the moon and go to Mars? Because it would just seem to me that it would...
Yeah, you could.
I mean, was
go.
It escape velocity problems, or what was it?
Most of it just has to do with the fact it wasn't built for it. It wasn't built to take the loads to get out of low Earth orbit. It wasn't built, I wouldn't bet my butt on 2 weeks there and back in something that was designed for low Earth orbit. It's good to be able to go home when you need to. You know, like the shuttle, you can get home pretty fast if something goes wrong. It just wasn't built for that kind of a mission. It doesn't have... It doesn't have all the systems that you'd want in place. It's fuel cell. You'd want to use solar power. It can't take the loads returning into the atmosphere. I mean, think about, you know, if you're coming back, you either get to do a long, long series, probably many weeks, of skipping off the atmosphere and coming back around and skipping off the atmosphere before you get low and slow enough to be captured into Earth orbit, or you have a different thermal protection system.
Right. I do recall reading that the Apollo spacecrafts were coming into the Earth's atmosphere at about 25,000 miles an hour, as opposed to the shuttle, which comes in at what, 13 or 14?
17,000.
17,000 miles an hour. But the shuttle, 20,000 miles an hour is quite a difference.
It's a big time difference, and you've got a vehicle that, you know, depends on, for its survival, a very great deal on the boundary layer effect. You won't get that with a capsule coming in. That's why you have to char and ablate. But, you couldn't take one to Mars. I sure wouldn't want to take the chance on all that micrometeorite debris chipping away at my tile on the way there. And it would actually be more expensive for you to try to take a shuttle and, you know, modify it to go to the moon or to go off to Mars.
Look at all that room you would have, though.
Yeah, but you can produce something on the ground that does exactly the same thing. It gives you all that payload bay room and everything else. And, back 15 years ago, there was the concept of Shuttle C, and Shuttle C was basically something the size of an orbiter with an aft end on it with three main engines that you could dispose of. And Shuttle C would put 120,000 pounds in the low Earth orbit, you could really, you know, for less money, you could build a really good system and put a spacecraft inside the bay of a shell sea and gotten to the moon a lot quicker, a lot cheaper, a lot less risk. It's really, you know, all of it really boils down more than anything to risk. You don't want to risk the lives of the crew. You don't want to take unnecessary risk. I mean, every time you fly, you take a risk, and that is just part of the nature of the game. But you do everything in your power to minimize risk. You know, take away the dumb risks. Really, really understand the risks you consider to be acceptable and get buy-in from all the relevant parties.
I was talking, speaking of the risks and going with the, all the foam problems that we're having with launching the shuttle and everything, I had heard somebody mention that the reason why we're having trouble with the foam popping off of the off of the launch vehicle is because not long ago they had to change the chemical makeup of the foam because it was, they actually determined it was harmful to the environment, and that was the, and that new, that new that new chemical, that new chemical makeup was actually not as strong as the original. Is that true?
The original foam was called CPR-488, and to my knowledge, there were very few foam shredding problems. It contained a lot of CFCs. So under the Golden administration, it was decided to remove that foam and use the BX-536. I can't remember what they're flying right now, but it's something like that. And, you know, there weren't foam shedding problems like before, but, you know, the commitment's been made. It's too late. You know, the decision was made 10 years ago. You couldn't go back to CPR 488 if you wanted to. You couldn't pay enough money to get the manufacturer to put it together. You know, I'm a funny kind of guy. When you have something that works, that you fly, you don't change it. But that's not my decision to make. And, you know, I'm sure there were other reasons why they picked it. But, yeah, that's true. That's true. Change the foam in the middle of the program and see what happens.
Or am I mistaken that we just – maybe we just didn't notice the issues with – we just didn't notice the issues of the foam back then until it actually caused a problem.
People noticed it. If you've ever held foam in your hand, it's insanely light. It's lighter than styrofoam. And part of the problem was people, I mean, I saw this. People held a piece of foam in their hand and said, there's no way that this is going to damage tile or go through reinforced carbon-carbon. If you knock your finger against a piece of reinforced carbon-carbon, it's pretty strong stuff. But when you accelerate, you know, a pound or a half-pound piece of foam to 700 miles an hour in the turbulent atmosphere between the external tank and the orbiter, 700 miles an hour, 2 ounces, will do a lot of harm. And they just didn't look at it the right way. That, you know, the first time, okay, you learn from that. And that's one of the reasons why we're very conscious on foam now. Why there, people are all, everyone's doing the right thing about foam. They're studying it. They're reviewing it. They're not taking any risks. You know, they're looking through as best they can. They've eliminated so many different threats from foam. It's pretty damn safe now. You'll always have a little bit of shedding. That's to be expected. But there's a size where it really can't do any damage. Also, there's a time when it can shred, too. After you get above the appreciable atmosphere, it's not going to get caught in turbulent airflow between the external tank and the orbiter. It's just going to ballistically fall straight off.
Right.
And that foam shedding you don't worry about because you're not going to hit anything. But it's that turbulent flow, those first couple of minutes, that you want to make sure that that tank has got as much integrity as possible. And that's exactly what they're doing. You know, I'd fly on it. Fly on it in a heartbeat.
Oh, that's somebody right. Asked me to fly if I would fly on it. I'd fly on it in a heartbeat. Please. It's not. I was just, I'm just curious. What about, I remember the first couple of launches of the space shuttle, the ET was actually painted white. Mm-hmm. Would a coat of paint actually help the foam to stay on?
I don't know if it would or wouldn't. I know that people looked into that, painting with a lacquer, all kinds of things. I don't know what the effects of that were, but I was a shuttle project engineer back before the first flight, and the only reason we took the paint off the tank, originally I'd be back up, it was there for aesthetic reasons only. We took it off because we saved about 600 pounds.
Well, that's what I heard. I heard that, and it's weird. Your memory becomes so ingrained with the image of that orange external tank, and then when you go back and you look at the white tank, it's just bizarre.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, we painted everything back then. By God, we were going to paint that.
Yeah, but, I mean, it looked cool.
It did. It was pretty.
It's but like you said, it was kind of that transition period of old Apollo thinking and old thinking versus they painted the Skylab CMs back then too, didn't they? There was a reason they did it.
They did.
Heating and everything.
They painted a quarter of each command module, and that was the side that faced the sun while they were docked.
Right.
But they painted those white for that reason, to reflect a lot of solar radiation. But, you know, back, one of the reasons why, besides the aesthetic reason that they painted the tank and everything back then, is that you're exposed to the Cape environment when you sit on the pad, and that's saltwater spray, the whole nine yards, and you just don't want to kind of, you know, let your vehicle sit in all the saltwater and spray and bird droppings and everything else unless you have a layer of protection, and everything gets painted. But now they realize that beyond the woodpecker problem about 11 years ago, we don't have to worry about it.
How did they solve the woodpecker problems?
They put up plastic owls all over the place. It worked, too. The woodpeckers did not come back. There are plastic owls all over that, and they get cooked about every flight, and they get replaced. But it was a good, humane way to keep the woodpeckers away. You know, let them go eat somebody else's $500 million tank.
Yeah, they kind of sometimes I kind sometimes you kind of forget that the Cape Canaveral is right in the middle of a wetland zone.
Yeah, National Wildlife Refuge.
National Wildlife Area.
Boy, they go out of their way to make sure that they save, you know, that they protect as much of the wildlife as possible.
Yeah.
They meet fantastically stringent regulations on the types of things they can build and what they can do. Unfortunately, you know, when it comes time to launch, it's bye bye birdie.
Yeah. Not much you can do about that.
Nope. Sometimes they just get, you know, there was one rather interesting picture of a bird that just happened to be right over the tank, right over the orbiter, right over the tank as they lifted off, and it bunked and went down the side of the external tank, and they never found the bird, but...
and became chicken.
He became chicken, big time.
I bet. Well, Tom, thank you for agreeing
glad to
be
do.
On my podcast. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to it yet.
I look forward to it. I haven't had a chance yet, but I'm going to put them on my iPod and listen to them one of these evenings.
Well, you can listen to it either on iTunes
mm-hmm.
or directly at apollotalks.com.
Sounds good.
My guest has been Tom Hancock. He's the chairman of the Save Skylab Project. You can find out more information at www.saveskylab.org. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.